The Mexican government is the cartel. The words of a high-level U.S. government informant. Stay tuned and listen to them yourself.
Caught you walking like a gangster. Saw you grabbing the controls. Now you're almost out of batteries. You got a sweater much too small. Poking at your navel. Point your finger to.
Welcome back to House of Death Informant Part 2. And if you guys who are listening right now haven't heard Part 1, our last week's show, I urge you to get on the website, expertwitnessradio.org, and listen to it, because it will blow your mind as it has blown mine. And there's not much of a mind left to blow, so I'm trying to hold on to my sensibilities. And just to give you a little hint of what we covered in last week's show, we're going to play a little clip of the informant, the ICE informant, the ex-DEA informant, who was, he's the guy who was aiding in the murders of at least a dozen people that we know of, giving an eyewitness description of how one of the murders went down, and how it was done with the help of 15 Mexican policemen, and the commander himself actually doing the murders for the drug cartel. And if this doesn't chill you, I guess nothing will.
And then he just grabbed him by the neck and put him face down on the floor. And they start to put like some kind of duct tape around their heads, but one of them start doing noise, so Commandant De Loya did signs to someone to pass him a gun, and with a silencer. So he shot this guy, and the other one, he heard the shot start making noise also, and so he shot him also.
Now, you heard it, folks. I mean, just imagine now that what you listen to was done, aided and abetted by a United States attorney, by a U.S. federal agent, and what you just heard done was done at least 12 times that we know of, not counting the tortures, and at least one of the people killed was an American citizen, and that one of the intended murders that brought this thing to light in the first place was the attempted murder of a DEA agent and his family, which brought screaming into the fray, or I should say roaring into the fray, one of our guests, Sandy Gonzalez. And before we play the rest of the informant's tape and the third tape that we have made by our second guest, Bill Conroy of Narco News, who I think should get a Pulitzer Prize for this kind of reporting. Sandy, I'd like you to first kind of tell the audience, yes, particularly the people who heard the first show, how you were notified about the murders and what you did, and what brought you into this that really brings us here today was your action.
Sure, I'll condense it.
As much as you can, you know, because a lot of people, I'm sure we're in New York, we got a huge listening audience, and a lot of people are listening to this for the first time.
Well, I was the agent in charge of the El Paso division of the DEA, and in January of 2004, I was notified by ICE that something was going down in Juarez. There was a threat to the lives of DEA personnel there, and they had to be evacuated. So we went ahead, and my people assisted with the evacuation. There was an investigation started immediately. A few days later, when we started finding out what was really going on, which was that there had been an informant involved in facilitating these murders, that there were 12 people buried in the backyard of a house in Juarez, and apparently there was some kind of government, U.S. government complicity in this, alleged complicity. I put it on paper. I wrote a letter basically demanding accountability, and sent it to my counterpart at ICE and to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and after that all hell broke loose. And you know, I was told to be quiet and not do anything, and this whole thing's been a huge cover-up since then.
Yeah, and one that you paid for dearly in your own sweat and tears, and in a lawsuit you were forced to retire, am I correct?
Well, I retired early because of the you know, the personalities involved and the relationships in government.
Yeah, you felt threatened. Like,
absolutely. I mean, there was relationships here that led all the way to the Justice Department and even the White House.
Yeah,
so,
that's exactly. You and I are in the same boat. I retired because I was scared S-less, right, at the end, that they're going to do something. I don't know what. These people who play with no rules, and if you don't play the game, it's like I told you off mic about, you know, my father, very much a street guy, saying that there is no hell like being the only guy playing straight in a dirty card game. And there you were. And here we are right now. And the informant that our other guest, Bill Conroy of NarcoNews.com, he had the drive, the courage to go push this story, this important story that no one else in media is talking, to the point where Bill Conroy tape recorded this informant and his activities, which to me, some of them are just horrifying, that nobody, not a stinking congressman, would stand up and demand the making available of interviews of all the government officials who were involved in this. They're all right now being covered up in something called the JAT report, which, by the way, you listeners can get involved in demanding your congressman ask for this JAT report.
Yeah, just go to the website right on the front page, and we'll have a link there for more information on what you can actually do about it. And the other thing, too, I want to, we were talking about this off mic between episodes. We've talked about Johnny Sutton, who was a U.S. attorney kind of responsible for keeping all of this under wraps, and he has since retired. And Sandy, you had said that he's now gone into business with John Ashcroft?
Yeah. Yes, they I guess they started a new law firm to, if I remember correctly, to represent high-level clients or something like that. I think, Bill, you may remember the wording.
It's technically to represent well-heeled corporate clients, you know, in government action. So basically the interface between corporate America and the government.
Yeah, in other words, I got a sign on the door that says, if you don't have deep pockets, don't knock.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man, God bless the buck. So, holy mackerel. Yeah, again, I mean, if you play the game, we both Sandy Gonzalez and I both learned that. You got to play the game. Yeah, you know, you.
Well, I think if we pay close attention to that firm, you're going to see Alberto Gonzalez sneaking in there.
Oh, yeah. And crime does pay. And loyalty to criminals in government does pay. because even if you're convicted, the press is going to pardon you. So, just no. Oh, my God. Thank you. You know, I'm so thankful that I have this show, because otherwise I'd be spending these hours on a psychiatrist's couch. Well, let's go forward. Let us play the voice of the informant himself, Lalo. Let's just call him Lalo, his nickname, who is now in jail awaiting deportation to Mexico, where he will surely be killed by the Mexican government, which he says is the cartel, and which the facts seem to bear out. Go ahead, Marcus.
And I think the next morning,
Santillan called me in my phone, and I'm aware this that Ice got this recording and keeps playing me. He say, "Hey, you know what? We take that decision because of killed these guys, because now you have to be in charge of the people he was leading. So now you take responsibility of these people and keep working with them." That's what the explanation of why they decide to kill him.
Okay, did you tell ICE about those two people getting murdered as well? Was that reported to ICE?
Yes, I reported, but not immediately. It was that happens on a Sunday. So that Sunday nothing happens. I think I called Monday after they listened that call that Santillan made to me, and I think they if I remember well, they just received me at the office at Tuesday, the next day. That's when they make the debrief, because they were busy doing something else.
And so basically, that was happened in like November 2003, and then in January is when the DEA agent and his family got approached by Santillan's men. And what do you remember about that? How did that happen from your point of view? Where they threatened the DEA agent in Juarez, and then DEA had to pull all its people out of Juarez.
Well, at that time, I don't remember exactly the date. I think it was the 14th, but since the 13th, the day before, Santillan told me he needs someone to go and open the house, so I sent one individual over there, since Alex was in bed because...
You have 1 minute left.
He was harmed. So we sent one individual over there, and nothing happens. But Santillan told us, "Hey, you know what? Tomorrow we're going to start very early. So I want this guy tomorrow at 8 in the morning to be ready in the house." We did that, and the next time Santillan called me early and told me, "Hey, is this guy at the house ready?" And I said, "Yes, it is." So he didn't call me until 11 in the morning. And he said, "All right, we are arriving to the house." I said, "The guy's there, ready, waiting for you." So that happens, and he didn't call me back till 1 in the afternoon, more or less. And he told me, "Hey, you know what? I need you to ask your friend. I was supposed to have a corrupt inspector from customs." And he said, "You know what? Ask him about an inspector of his name." He gave me a name. So I call Raul.
Thank you for using Evercom.
Right. I just on the DEA matter, we were talking about that when we lost the call, because we can only talk for 15 minute clips here before the prison phone cuts off. But what I was wondering about that is essentially Santillan brought three people there and tortured them, one of whom was Luis Padilla, who was a legal U.S. resident, and the other one was another individual was an Omar. A guy named Omar, who apparently was the reason they were all brought there, because he had killed a bunch of people in Chihuahua and basically got Vicente Carrillo Fuentes angered over that and ordered his death. And tell me if that's correct. And then after the murder, one of those guys gave up an address, and somehow, whether it was confusion or a mistake or whatever, they ended up going to this DEA agent's house, and his wife answered, and the long and short of it is the agent came back, got his wife, and they tried to get out of Juarez, and that's when Santillan's men stopped them, thinking he was a crime inspector. Is that correct?
Yes, it's almost correct. But the only thing is, the address wasn't confusion. The address was exactly the address this guy gave to Santillan, and yeah, at that time the state police stopped.
How would they know that? How would the guys know that that was the address of a DEA agent? I mean, that's the question.
Well, they didn't know. This is what I'm going to elaborate right now. At that time, they just went to that house and to see what they can see over there, just to find what. And they saw Homer Glenn coming out with his wife and I don't know if his kid. So they stopped him. But at that time, the state police didn't know that Homer Glenn was a DEA agent. Didn't know that the state police who were trying to stop him was cartel people. Yeah.
How did what I'm asking? Then go back to where you were. How did one of those three people that was tortured gave that address up? How would they know it was the address of a DEA agent house, or is that just a total fluke that they just gave an address and it turned out to be a DEA agent?
Well, what happened is that Padilla was a DEA informant. So I think when he saw all the force from Omar to get free from these guys, and when he saw nothing works for them, he just did this. I don't know if it with the hope of get a deal with these people of the cartel, or maybe that if they go over there, they'll find troubles or resistance or something that can help him to get free. I don't know. I really don't know. I can say why he gave that address, but we know he gave that address. He's the one who provided the address, and then they went to investigate. So, like I said, nobody knows nothing at that time. Everybody just found when Santillan asked me the names of Homer Glenn and René Ramirez. So I passed it. I called. I tried to contact Raúl. He didn't answer me. So I called this Curtis Compton, asked him the names, and he recognized him. So he put a Spanish speaker agent, Luis Rico, who called me back, and he told me, you know what's going on, because these are the guys from DEA Juarez. So I told him, well, they are about to someone told Santillan that this is a safe house from a corrupt inspector, that they got drugs over there, and they're gonna check down that house. So you better let them know that they better run from there. So that's what basically I don't know what I did. They just called me back again and say, you know what? Then call me back and he say, hey, you know what? We want you in the Homeland Security building right now. So I just drive over there. When I arrived there, the ASAC, which never talked to me, comes and receives me and give me her hand and say, hey, we really appreciate what you did. You just saved this guy's life. And I said, well, I don't, I'm just passing the information, what's going on. And we keep in contact with Santillan to try. We never told him they were DEA agents. We just delayed the response from my people. And at some time that night, they decide that next day they have to arrest Santillan, so I have to bring him into the USO. That's basically what happened that day.
So, wow, it's kind of interesting. In essence, he's responsible for saving the life of a DEA agent, whether it was wittingly or unwittingly.
Well, from the way he's putting it there, yes, although I'm not sure that following that traffic stop, that the agent and his family were gonna remain in Juarez that night.
Right.
Because in fact I believe when they left the house they were going to El Paso, they were leaving.
Right. Yeah, they actually, the agent was thinking on his feet, he didn't get out of the car. If he would have gotten out of the car at that traffic stop, I think that would have been it for him.
Yeah.
He immediately called the embassy, and the DEA dispatched another guy to get over there, and you know, that's, I think, what saved him.
Well, it's almost identical to what happened to Kiki Camarena, DEA, for those of you who don't know the name, DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena was working in Guadalajara, and the state police working for the cartel there stopped him around lunchtime, got him out of his car, and he was never seen again until his body was found, and he'd been tortured slowly to death. So Homer Glenn, I think that's his name, Homer Glenn was the DEA agent. Homer Glenn must have been, you know, well aware of the Kiki Camarena story when the state police stopped him.
Probably.
Yeah. And does your information differ at all, Sandy Gonzalez?
No, I mean, it's my sense that he was coming out of Juarez that night, just based on the fact that those people had gone to his house and knocked on the door, you know, and I guess his wife didn't open the door, and then when they left, they were stopped on a traffic stop by a uniformed policeman, then followed by these plainclothes guys, you know, the killers, actually.
Yeah. That's pretty tense.
I don't think he was going to go back that night.
Yeah, no, that's yeah, he just, the irony, I mean, thank God it didn't happen, but the irony of a DEA agent even being threatened, you know, where his life is threatened by an operation that had been ongoing, a murder and torture operation that had been ongoing with the knowledge of the U.S. government for some period of time prior to that. How this doesn't inspire some congressman, some senator, some of our protectors to just seek the full truth of this whole sordid affair just is mind-boggling to me. And, you know, God bless you, Bill Conroy, for pursuing it, and God bless you, Sandy Gonzalez, for bringing this whole thing to light. I don't know. Do you want to play the...
Yeah, I just wanted to ask just a clarification. So what you're saying is... When the traffic stop happened, that basically he made a telephone call and then sat in the car until somebody else came and met him and the family?
Yes.
Right, exactly. And at the same time, Santillan was on the phone to the informant trying to figure out who he had stopped, because he thought he stopped a corrupt inspector, didn't realize it was DEA. And then
right.
ICE found out, was tracking down, and then ICE discovered, oh, they got DEA agents. So all this was happening simultaneously, all three parties kind of working, you know, until the truth was discovered, you know. And apparently Santillan never was told what happened then, as they let him go, because the DEA, an agent from the embassy came and ran some interference and showed him some diplomatic credentials. So at that point, Santillan knew, well, I don't know who they are, but they're definitely with the U.S. government. So he let him go, and then they lured Santillan across the border within a day of that and arrested him.
But that explains why the Customs Associates Act was so so excited, or whatever you want to call it, you know, when she called me to tell me, because she was agitated, what she was. That's because they knew what these people were up to and what they were doing, and when they realized that they had done this with a DEA agent, they probably said, oh boy.
Oh boy is right. Well, what kind of questions did you ask her, the Customs ASAC? Who was it anyway, Sandy, the Customs ASAC? I'm just
Patty Kramer's her name. Basically, I didn't ask her very many questions because I didn't know what this was about when she called.
Yeah.
She just said, hey, we need your help. And I was in Washington, and she said, we need your help in this matter. You know, we need to get these people out and all that. So I just made a call to El Paso, and I told one of my ASACs, hey, do whatever it takes to do this, to bring the people out and put them in a safe place.
Well, when was the first time you realized that the DEA agents under your command, the DEA agent and his family, his wife and children, were about to or came close to being murdered by a customs-run or an ICE-run operation? When was the first...
First of all, he wasn't under my command. He worked for Mexico City.
Okay.
Of course, El Paso is right across the border. We're a domestic side of DEA. They were on the international side of DEA. But
so you actually kind of stepped out of bounds.
No, we were helping. We were assisting the Mexico City office in everything they were doing as far as the the evacuation and the investigation of the threat and.
So when was the aha moment where you said, oh, you know, that's what I'm trying to identify.
Well, okay. At one point there in January, I got direction from the chief of operations to get more involved in the issue. And the reason for that was because they weren't getting the story up in Washington. You know, it was all, you know, it was murky. Everything was really murky. So the chief of operations asked me, called me and said, you know, what do you know? What are you doing? What's the SAC, you know, your counterpart at ICE telling you? And I told them at the time, well, this is being handled by Mexico City. My role is a support role. Which they sort of knew. I mean, this was an international thing.
Sure.
On the international side of DEA. So at that point, he told me, well, you know, you should get more involved. It's in El Paso, you know, it's ICE El Paso and all that. So I said, okay, got it. And at that point, I started getting personally involved and finding out what was going on. And
yeah, asking the
that's what led to the letter.
Yeah. So, but who, you know, what was the moment before you wrote that letter? Who did you contact in ICE? Well, what was the information, the moment, the time where you suddenly realized that this whole thing was being covered up, that there was a government-run murder operation, and it almost killed a DEA agent, and what you're finding out, that this thing is being run, government, sponsored or overseen by a United States attorney, that'd be a horrifying moment.
Well, it came gradually, okay? After the chief of operations gave me that direction, I started meeting with and speaking with the agents that were conducting the investigation. That were trying to find out what happened, okay? And they were all working out of my office. They were all Juarez agents who were working out of El Paso because they couldn't go back to their office yet until the threat was resolved, okay? So I started meeting with them on a daily basis, twice, three times a day, finding out what they were learning from speaking to, you know, sources, informants, and the ICE agents. And I attended a couple of meetings with everybody, you know, the ICE hierarchy and the ASACs and the SAC. And finally, when I got wind, you know, eventually after several days, I kind of got the picture. And at that point, I had a long conversation with the SAC, with my counterpart. And, you know, the tone of the conversation and his answers to my questions just were not acceptable. And it was at that point that I said, well...
You interrogated a few thousand people in your career. The guy was lying. Am I right?
Well,
or you sensed he was lying. Or all the tells, you know, in poker, tells, all the tells of lie were assaulting you, as I used to say. You know, I'm talking to you, man, but every time your mouth moves, I could feel
well,
the tells.
Well, the key thing was this. During my conversation with him, he started to blame DEA agents for this mess. And I said, hey, there's no way. There's no way that DEA agents are to blame for this. And then the guy says, well, you know, one of your agents came in here yelling and screaming and all that. And I said, well, if you were in his shoes, and, you know, what would you do? You know, that's really what, when I realized that they were working towards putting some blame on DEA about this, I said, well, this is it. Let me just report everything that I know up to this point.
Yeah. Wow.
And get it out there.
Yeah. Oh, Sandy, I'm reliving my own nightmares. Yeah, you're making me flashback. We're going to take a...
I know. He's starting to, like, convulse involuntarily over here.
I'm shaking here.
We're going to take a break. We're talking to Bill Conroy and Sandy Gonzalez about the ever-ongoing and it-won't-go-away story as a house of death.
We're not letting it go away.
No, absolutely not. We're going to take a break for 30 seconds. We'll be right back with you. Everybody, just stand by.
You are listening to the Expert Witness Radio Show. For more information on tonight's show, please visit us on the web at www.expertwitnessradio.org.
We are back, and we only have a half an hour left. So what I want to do is go right into the last segment of Bill Conroy's interview of Lalo the informant.
Okay. Here's the rest of Lalo.
Now, during this, you know, you were supposedly paid by ICE like more than $200,000, or at least that's what the court records say. Did they, I mean, how did they pay you? Did they pay you after you gave them information, or was it like a regular thing where they just paid you so much every month? I mean, how did that work?
Are you supposed to be paid by case? By case, once we close the case, it takes several months, a long time to get paid by the case. And in other, that was in the beginning. But then when we get stuck with the case of the cigarettes in Santillan, because they were very, very long cases, and then, like, we were done with the cigarette case, but they cannot make the arrest because it's going to affect the cartel case. So they just start helping me with small case, like $4,000, every now and then. They don't really get a time. Just as we were busting drugs, they just say, hey, this is just for help you in the meantime, but don't worry, we're going to pay you for that. And they even owe me another cases we did. Other different cases in other places, and they still owe me that money. They never paid me, not for the cigarettes, not for Santillan, not for the other cases, cocaine cases in McAllen, like for almost 500 kilos of cocaine, in Los Angeles, 150 kilos of cocaine. They never paid for that.
Okay, now, so the other thing I was going to ask you, how many, if you had a guess, murders at the House of Death was ICE made aware of? At one point I thought you said 5 to 6, either through monitoring your calls or because you were debriefed about them. Is that it?
Well, I think murders that actually happened there, that should be 1, 2, just 3 and the 6 of them.
Okay, so there are 6 that actually were killed in the house. And ICE would have been made aware either before or after every one of those by you, right?
Yes.
And they didn't make any, they had enough to arrest Santillan in March of 2003 before the Reyes murder. But they kept the case going even after they were aware of all these murders continuing to happen. Do you know why? Is that accurate? And do you know why, or what's your thought on that?
Well, I don't know why. I wasn't in a position to ask. I was just an operative informant. I did a lot of job for doing what I did, because I wasn't supporting Mexican soil for nobody. Yeah, the best thing the ICE could be is infiltrate some U.S. agents at some point of investigation, and then I can get out. And they just keep going, and they're arrested, so I don't get the hit. But no, they never seem to have someone who can go, so they have to still working through me, and I don't know why they are the ones who call the shots. I don't know why they don't decide to arrest. What I do know is that it was senseless to alert the Mexican authorities, because the Mexican authorities, they already know about the murders. Actually, they performed the murders. Yeah. They are the ones who killing, and to support this, we got the case of the two of these people. They were killed there because they point a stash house from the cartel to the PGR, and the PGR just called the cartel. They say, all right, let us get your information from where you live and everything, and we just inform them. And the PGR just called the cartel. That this is what usually happens in Mexico, and tell them, hey, you know what, these guys are telling about you. So the cartel sent the state police, pick him up and bring him to the house, and they kill him there. That's the way it works in Mexico. So they can't really, ICE can do anything, because if they call, then they're going to say, what they're going to do is they're going to kill everybody who knows about that house, because they know there's a leak
to the U.S. government.
But at the same time, if they would have arrested Santillan in March, like instead of waiting until the March of 2003, instead of waiting to January of 2004, there would have been at least, probably, arguably, at least 11 or 12 people still alive, or at least that wouldn't have...
No, that isn't accurate neither, because these people wasn't killed because of Santillan. These people was killed because of their relationship with the cartel. At some point they do something that the cartel doesn't need Santillan to go and kill these people. They send the state police. The only thing that they get killed in that house is because Santillan was desperately trying to offer some kind of useful work, because in the U.S. side we were busting everything. We were all the achievements Santillan working that put me through, we bust them. At some point he told the number one, well, we can do nothing for you in the U.S. And that was another thing that I was desperate to close the case, because at some point someone gonna think, well, who's the only one who been to all of this, and that was me. So they're gonna say that I am the one who is busting the thing. Do you understand that?
Yeah, no, I understand that, but
I was very, very, very worried that this thing doesn't stop and I just keep producing arrest, everything points at me. But honestly, none of these guys were killed because of the work of Santillan or me with ICE. They were killed for other different situations with their own relationship with the cartel.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Santillan was part of the cartel, and you were working as an informant, and you had to play the role, at least, of being part of the cartel. So you can't really say they were killed for something, not because of Santillan, because Santillan was working for the cartel. That's the problem here, as I see it, is you know, you can't really separate what happened from the players that actually carried out the murders. They had enough information to break up Santillan's cell way before the...
I agree, they can arrest Santillan since March when we did that cocaine bust, or since August when Fernando Reyes killing, yeah? But anyway, it's like Santillan is arrested in 2004, and how many people the cartel is still killing? They are still killing people because that's the nature of that.
You have 1 minute left.
That gets to be philosophical. People have to decide what they think about that. The difference is ICE and you, as their informant, were involved, you know, in the middle of these murders, in the sense that's different when law enforcement on this side of the border knows about them. That's what some would argue.
This side of the border, I agree completely. If they were in this side of the border, they can do something. In the Mexican side, you can do nothing, because first, you got no authority over there, and second, the ones who have authority are the ones who are performing the killing. That's what the American government at the high levels are failing to realize, and that's why the war on drugs is such a travesty, because the main enemy is the one who they are giving the...
Thank you for using Evercom.
Well,
the Mexican government is the cartel over and over and over, he says. And then what the American people don't understand is that there is no difference between dealing with the Mexican government and the cartel. They are all one. Sandy, and first, Bill, let me tell you, congratulations. Just a fantastic job. And I'm giving you a standing applause here. You don't listen for it, but absolutely great, great,
really?
Great job. Sandy and Bill, maybe both of you. I want to get to that question I asked Sandy before the break. The claim. Now, let's say Johnny Sutton, the United States Attorney's, the head of the U.S. Attorney's Office, that was overseeing this whole operation of murder and death. If he sat down here on the mic and he said, "Well, you heard the guy. What can we do?" As a matter of fact, if you heard the first Lalo tape, he claims that the ICE commander called the Mexican government immediately with the first murder he had taken part in, and they were disinterested, totally. disinterested, and all of it appears true. Mexican government functions like a cartel, going all the way back to my own book, Deep Cover. There's no doubt, I mean, in my mind, that you're dealing with one big cartel in Mexico, as the ex-customs chief back in the 80s, Dwight Rabb, said before Congress, it's a bandito government. And then they censured him. So what about that claim, guys? I mean, Sutton tells you, look, we couldn't call because they weren't going to do anything anyway. It's their government, their police. Is that claim valid?
Well, I'm not sure that it's totally valid. I believe that at a high enough diplomatic level, that at least we have the moral, if not the legal or both obligations to do something. And at a high enough diplomatic level, something can be done, you know, even if it's, just to keep us happy, you know.
But I mean, if he's saying that we're in the sense that this operation, the House of Death operation, with Lalo working as an informant and the U.S. government or Sutton's office and the ICE agents being aware that it was really a mill of murder and torture, but yet allowing it to persist, comes under the rubric of what else are you going to do? Is that a valid claim? What else are you going
to?
Yeah.
The thing that I was trying to. People do have to decide this. They could have busted Santillan, and if they would have busted Santillan, maybe they would have got Loya. Remember, they tried the police commander that was the head of these state cops that were working for Santillan. They tried to arrest them later too, but they got tipped off. But they might have been able to get all these guys swept off that entire cell, and it would have set the cartel back, you know, months maybe. And sure, they're replaceable. That goes to the big question of if what he's saying is true. How is the drug war ever going to work to begin with? Well, I mean, what's the point of it?
Now you're getting into a question that we can go on ad nauseum, and everybody's talking about it. But we're talking right now about specific crimes committed by U.S. officials, and whether or not they committed them, or whether or not can you claim, well, the whole drug war is a fraud, therefore
It's commissioned by omission.
Commission? No, I don't know if it's commissioned by omission or commissioned, but at some point that's something for a jury to take. Let me go to Sandy. Have crimes been committed under Title 18 or under any of the U.S. statutes that you were made aware of during your investigation? Or is there probable cause of same?
Well, I think the most obvious alleged crime here would be accessory to murder. Just to clarify one point, when we tried to arrest Loya, ICE and the U.S. Attorney's Office would not allow us to work with the informant to put a call to Loya so that he could be, so an arrest could be arranged.
I don't believe that. What was their reason?
Their reason was that they didn't want to burn the informant on that other cigarette case. That's what they said. But to get to your other question, I think, whatever, if we were allowed to do an investigation right now, I think the way to start would be with a JAT report, because I think this investigation is being conducted. It just hasn't been acted upon.
Okay, the JAT report, of course, is a non-criminal investigation, but an interview, a fact-finding interview of all
right.
The people involved, 40-some-odd statements that are now being held as secret. The government is not turning them over. Bill Conroy is trying to get them through FOIA. And I agree. We begin with the JAT report. Do you think, Sandy Gonzalez, because you've been, you've been head on into this for years now. Do you think we will find perjured, or we will find instances of perjured testimony and/or violations of Title 18, 1001, false official statements? These are felonies. Is there already probable cause of that before we get the JAT report?
Possibly. See, you got to go back to those sworn statements in the civil case. All of these people admitted that they knew about the first murder and that they went ahead and got approval from San Antonio and Washington to continue using the informant. So they're all giving themselves up.
So they gave themselves up with the assurance that nobody's going to move against them criminally.
Right.
Yeah. Talk about, by the way, you mentioned the civil case. Give the audience quickly what that civil case involved. That was you suing DEA. Is that a fact?
No, I'm talking about the civil case filed by the families.
Oh, okay.
Of some of these victims, you know, for wrongful death or whatever it was.
Yeah.
In that case, you know, the ICE agents and U.S. Attorney's Office personnel gave sworn statements admitting, you know, knowing about the first murder and so on and so forth, and saying, you know, passing the buck, saying, well, you know, we told our bosses in San Antonio, and they went to Washington, and so and so, they even named the guy, an assistant attorney general, gave the approval to continue using the informant. Now, to go back just a little bit to what I said.
Let's hold right there just for a second. This assistant attorney general now becomes a target of our investigation, you and me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the thing that I wanted to clarify real quick here, when I said before, you know, that moment when I found out that they were trying to blame DEA, in my civil case, you know, for retaliation here in Miami, the then deputy administrator of DEA testified and stated clearly that ICE was at fault for everything that happened there and not DEA, and that's on a record.
Yeah, but
go ahead Bill. There's a question that's been raised and never answered, because this document hasn't been released either. After the first murder, they had to get authorization from a federal judge to continue the wiretap on Santillan. And in that affidavit, there's been allegations made that they did not tell the judge that their informant participated in the murder.
They had to lie. That's known as a lie by omission.
We don't know that. We haven't seen it, but that's been raised as an issue. And secondly, one of the victims, the U.S. citizen David Castro, who's supposed to be buried at the House of Death, in the list of bodies that show up that the Mexican government released, his name is not there. And I know for a fact from sources that know the family of David Castro, his body to this day has not been found.
Or identified.
Found or identified.
Yeah, I mean,
where you see, so you've got payroll, the informant, saying that the guy's body was buried there, and now the body, when it becomes a legal matter involving U.S. liability, the body vanishes.
Well, I'm not sure that the body has not been found. Perhaps it hasn't been identified.
Yeah.
And at this point, it never will be.
Okay, so we've got it. At this point, what I'm trying to sift out here is you and I have this job, this mystical, magical job that's never going to happen, because we got a Congress without cojones. They're not going to do a thing. They never have in the past. They never will in the future. But let's say in this case, one congressman on an LSD acid trip reads about the House of Death, and he says, we can't let this go on, and let's get this Levine and Gonzalez out here. That's what they did. That's what they did between the two of them for 60-some-odd years. Let's give them credentials and let them investigate, a search for truth investigation, and indict wherever the cards fall. And so we've got one of the targets, clearly, is this Attorney General in the United States Justice Department, who authorized the continuation of it. Let me ask you this. Another target, I would say, are the people whoever signed the affidavit asking the Title III, the wiretap on the informant's phone, to continue and omitted what they had. Would you say that those people are good targets for perjury?
There are many ways to go on this, Mike. I mean,
Yeah, I know. I just love thinking about it. I mean, it's kind of like making love. There's many ways to do it, but go ahead, Bill.
There's also allegations that documents have been shredded to cover some of the paper trail on this. That would be the interesting thing to see, is what actually is still there.
I, I, they would have, I want to tell you, Bill, they don't want to turn Sandy and me loose on this because we'll fill up a new wing in the Metropolitan House of Detention. I would love to do it. You listening? If there's some congressman crazy enough to do this, I volunteer. I absolutely volunteer. How about you, Sandy? You volunteer?
Well, yeah, I'd love to do it, but I mean, I would honestly have to recuse myself.
No, I wouldn't let you. There's no way you're recusing yourself. You're not getting out of this one, man. This is kind of like Custer's last stand. Let's talk a little bit about Johnny Sutton. Johnny Sutton, of course, is, you know, now has made his bones as the prosecutor who put these two poor Border Patrol guys who, by all accounts, shot an armed drug dealer in the butt. And these two guys doing their job, basically, I think they just had, they did not have the best representation at trial. In my opinion, I don't know. They were convicted with Johnny Sutton. Did he personally prosecute that case?
I don't think so, no.
But he
has to approve those. He's also prosecuting the one that started the prosecution against Sally Castile.
Is he, so, his office, oh my God, you know, Jesus. Hey, there's another show. We've had Sully on here. So Johnny Sutton, I would say he would naturally become a target of our investigation as to what he knew, when he knew, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not going to happen because he's now in a deep pockets law firm and is he getting a television show or something like that? Did I hear this?
I don't know.
He made reference at one of the press conferences that now he can be the conservative voice of reason in the media. So I would expect him to show up on the talking head pundit circle here and there.
I mean, I agree, but I think there's enough probable cause here where before you do that, we bring him before a grand jury and just answer some questions just about the House, his involvement and his knowledge in the House of Death case.
And who's going to do that?
Well, if they... I'll do it.
No, I mean, if you could impanel a grand jury, if you had that authority, I'm sure you would.
Yeah.
but I think the fact is that this case has reached a level in the government that no one wants to touch, and that is a United States attorney, personal friend of a former president. And even, when these things happen, like with Scooter Libby, you saw what happened.
Oh, my God.
He got, pardoned or whatever the legal terminology is. He never spent a day in jail. And whatever crimes we're talking about here.
Well, you know something, Scooter Libby did. I kind of feel sorry for Scooter Libby. I'm sorry, and this is why. As I wrote in Deep Cover, I said Edwin Meese, the Attorney General of the United States, basically outed a whole undercover team working Deep Cover in Mexico, Bolivia, when he called the Attorney General of Mexico and warned him about us. Of course, NAFTA was on the drawing board then, and if the American people knew what we, the undercover team, were learning, it never would have passed. It just never would have passed as law. But that came out in the New York Times bestseller, and nothing was done. We're not talking about a CIA employee who it's very debatable whether he really put her in any danger, but Edwin Meese put us in grave, grave danger.
Yeah, something should have been done about it, though.
Yeah.
No,
so,
at a minimum, maybe remember the names, because Garcia, who was the U.S. attorney there in New York, was the head of ICE when all this happened. And Sutton, when these guys start running for office, at least remember this case before you elect them.
Yeah.
Yeah, you New Yorkers, and unfortunately for you New Yorkers listening to this, the only place you're going to hear this stuff is on the Expert Witness radio show, not the New York Times. That's why they're going out of business. Not
good riddance. Now,
what am I, listeners, what am I going to do? Now that Michael Jackson's gone, all I have is you guys out there at the other.
Oh, man. Well, listen, I want to say once again, please, when you finish listening to the show, go to the website, Expert expertwitnessradio.org, and you'll find a link there. Actually, you'll find a bunch of links there to previous episodes, but also to information on the JAT report, which is something that really needs to be brought out into the open. And we are, like, we got 2 minutes to go here, so I want to say really quickly, Bill Conroy, thank you so much for sticking your neck out and hammering on this over and over and over again. And
nobody else is.
Yeah, and most especially for the awesome tape that you got us for these past two episodes. And Sandy, well, you're just one of our heroes, as always.
Yeah, Sandy.
And Mikey, why don't you say
that's
goodbye?
That's it. I'm fine.
You're too kind.
We're gonna give you the Expert Witness Radio Show Medal of Valor, which is, you know what? It's worth something.
Wait, we have those?
Yeah. Well, we're gonna
have. That's better than some of the one Chris Matthews gives.
Yeah.
The hardball. It's better than the hardball medal.
Oh my God. You know, the softball. Anyway, you guys, I love the both of you. Thank you so much. All New York City thanks you. Believe me, they do. And my wife Laura Cavanaugh Levine. Oh boy, do I love you, te amo, mamita. Yeah, boy. I just love that woman. That's what I live for. Now that Michael's gone, especially, you know, it's gone.
Oh. All right. Hey, listen, and yeah, thank you. Wherever and whenever you listen to this, thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you next time. You take care. Ciao.